You're listening to Wake Up Tucson. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, welcome back to the Wake Up Tucson show, 10:30 The Voice, local news and talk. We've been providing the best after day morning after the primary coverage in Southern Arizona. And again, Grant and Josh are going to continue that with call-ins from Heather Lapp and Juan Siscomani coming up in the next hour. And if you miss anything, kvoi.com. And before we get to Danny, I just want to let you guys know, 2 weeks from Saturday is our amazing fundraiser for Honor Flight at the Westward Look Resort. Please let me, you do have to let me know you're coming at wakeuptucson@gmail.com. $45 payable at the door gets you dinner, dancing, night at the USO, and we raise money for Korean War, World War II, the few that are out there, and Vietnam War vets to go back to the war memorials in D.C. So love helping them out. I can't wait to see you guys. And please, if you're a business and you can donate something cool for silent auction, we've already got some great stuff, including a chunk of gold from Tucson Coin and Autograph. wakeuptucson@gmail.com. All right, let's go. Part two. We came back for more hurt and questions, as we say here at Wake Up Tucson. Concert promoter extraordinaire, Danny Zalisco, on with Chris and David Slavin. Danny, what's up, my friend? Danny,
is there?
Hey,
hi.
Good morning, Danny.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
We're doing good. So I just want to start off with a weird coincidence. So we're driving back. We spent a few days up in Flagstaff. We're coming back. Uh-huh. It's about 10:30 as I'm driving through Phoenix to get down here. And I said, you know, it's 10:30. I want a cup of coffee, a bite to eat, and go to the bathroom. And I ended up at the new White Castle on Warner and I-10.
Yeah.
And there's this weird gold-looking table in the corner. And I said, what's that? It's the Danny Zalisco Cravers Hall of Fame table. So that's where I ate my coffee and my two sliders was at the Danny Zalisco table 48 hours ago. So felt this extra connection.
I'm very happy you could experience such a thing.
How do you become part of the Cravers Hall of Fame?
Well, I met the family that owns and runs White Castle some years back when they did their first store here in Phoenix in Scottsdale, and they had an Alice Cooper table. So Alice was there for the groundbreaking for that, and they gave him a giant spatula that was like the shovel where you break ground. So Alice came by and he says, "Here, you can have my shovel." So it's still sitting here in my living room. So I got to be friends with these guys and we got involved doing some things. And since then, they put me and John Prine and Tommy Shaw from Styx in the White Castle Cravers Hall of Fame.
What a great story.
Because, yeah, so, you know, like when we have shows up here, especially, you know, at Celebrity or the Rhythm Room or something like that, I'll send out for a box or two, you know, to feed the band after the show. A couple of times I've just got 10 boxes and start feeding the audience. And, you know, the funniest thing about giving people White Castles, they see the box, they smell it, and at first they go, "Oh, no, I couldn't." And then they're diving in with everybody else.
Or there's these people who poo-poo it. They go, "Oh, that's trash,"
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, and then I start saying, "Dinner and a show." Yeah. And they go, "Okay."
Well, as Matt said, with the one in open in front of IKEA, our amazing producer, you can get little hamburgers at White Castle and little meatballs at IKEA. So they're just mailing it over there.
Okay.
All right.
Hey, Danny. Yeah. Danny, I
David,
got a question.
Start us off.
You, I have a kind of a special relationship. Well, it's special to me with John Lodge over the last 40 years. And this last weekend,
who's John Lodge for the
John
rookies
Lodge
out there?
Of the Moody Blues, and the Moody Blues have been my favorite since I was preteen, and it was interesting. I hear you got to play guitar on Ride My Seesaw and the Encore the other night, producing two John Lodge shows on the East Coast.
Well, actually, I'm not a guitar player, but I did manage to get up and warble some of the song Ride My Seesaw, which was their last song.
All right. What a treat.
And
I'm envious.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun, and you know, I didn't get busted for voice cracking or anything. I know it did a couple times. I mean, when you're not in singing form, just like any other thing, like weightlifting or anything like that, you're bound to make some mistakes, or your voice just isn't ready for it. It's weird. I used to sing in a group long, long time ago, and I realized that I'd be better on this side of the microphone than the other. But I sure like doing it. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, neat. What a great, great story. I wish I had seen some pics online, but it was nice reading
there
about that. Well, there I saw a pic of you with John after the show, but I didn't see a pic of you during Ride My Seesaw.
Look on the on my page. There's one on there where in a multi kind of a pictured thing.
All right, I'll go back and check it out.
So, Danny, it's all about how you sell it. One man's voice crack is another person's vocal fry. You just got to sell it, baby. You just got to sell it.
they liked it. That's all that mattered. They didn't kill me, so that's what I was happy about.
Well, great. Well, hey, I got a question for you. When somebody like a John Lodge goes out on tour, take a Sticks or whatever, I always wondered what the internal process was. How do they go about putting a tour together? Do they go to their managers and say, we've got an album ready to go, and then the managers go to a talent agency and say, we're ready to go? How does it come down to eventually Danny Zalesko presents, gets to put a show on in a particular city, in any given city?
That's a good question.
Well, after you are known to these people over the years, in my case it's been 5 decades, and you're into a certain type of act, or you're representing a certain area of the country, or they know you from before, there's a million ways for the connection to take place. But in the case of, like, say, Sticks, for example, they're represented by a major agency that's got offices all over the world, and I'm always in touch with them and their manager, and it'll just come up in conversation. Hey, we're coming out there in November. Let's do Tucson and Prescott, because they'd already done Phoenix earlier in the year, and they're saving that for next year, which they're going to do again. So it's kind of like a process where you're involved with, you know, with some bands I'm really involved and I know exactly what's going on all the time, and I don't have to worry about somebody else coming in and making a bigger offer and stealing it. But that's getting rarer and rarer these days, because there's a lot of poachers out there. I mean, in the old days, they'd call it stealing cattle. But because that's what I feel like when somebody calls up on a show that I've been doing for either just the last time or many times before that, and suddenly some opportunist comes along. Oh, I think I want to do that show. There's an honor among thieves as concert promoters, where you typically don't go after other people's groups. It's kind of like stealing their cattle. And this is what you live on. I mean, you live on the loyalty from the groups. But a lot of times these groups will change agents, they'll change managers, nobody keeps records, and nobody's calling me up out of nowhere to say, hey, remember you did so-and-so. It just happened this morning before we got on the phone with Alan Parsons. His agent is notifying people in markets that I've done before, saying, hey, he's available. And it's like, wait a minute, you didn't even send this to me yet.
Right.
You know, so there's all that. But in the meantime, yeah, what will happen is the act itself first has to have it together amongst themselves to say, we're going to tour in October and November. We'd like to start in the West Coast and come back east. Well, if it's November, start in the East Coast and come west because the weather's better. And then you'll go and you'll look for the venues that they might play in to find out what dates they're open. And you have to do that like 20 or 30 times, maybe not just me, but other promoters as well, where they look to try to piece together how the tour is going to work, because the tour has to move along in a geographical, you know, with logic, where you go from Tucson to Phoenix to Vegas, not Vegas to Tucson to Phoenix to Denver. You know what I mean?
Sure.
They got to draw lines where they don't want to be more than 250, 300 miles apart from the next show.
When you can't waste money on transportation costs that you don't need to waste money on, right?
Right. Not to mention when you're driving, you know, there's just the wear and tear on everybody. I mean, an extra 100 miles is like a million miles sometimes.
Right.
So, you know, so you have to have your tour all set like that, where you start November, you end in December, and it has to make sense so that it's the most economical, but also makes the most sense for that town, because some towns you really want to have a Friday or Saturday night, or you really need one, and in other towns, not as much, but there's only two weekend dates per week, so you got to be careful with how you choose.
All right, Danny, hold on for 2 seconds. I got to go visit some of our great sponsors. Could you hold on for a sec, please?
Sure.
Thanks, buddy. We're talking to Danny Zaliska. If you have a question or comment, 790-2040 is the phone number. Wake up Tucson at comments@gmail.com. Ride My Seesaw. Is this the one with Danny on rhythm? Just want to make sure.
Absolutely.
Here we go. Wake up Tucson. All right. 8:22 in the morning. Those Aussies, those crazy Aussies at Ice House bringing us in. We're hanging out with Danny Zaliska, a concert promoter extraordinaire. Danny, welcome back.
I'm here. How are you?
Well, we're awesome. Hey, question for you. A couple of questions I've always wondered about is,
yeah.
So when a band or an act decides, when they're planning out their tour, how do they decide which cities to go to and which cities to avoid? I assume in the 70s, 80s, you had airplay, record sales, things like this. What's the rule now on the business side of them figuring out what cities to be? Because I'm a prog rock guy. I'm watching Jeff Downs by himself do Asia with three guys, and they're trying to figure out the East Coast and South. So how do on the business side, how do they determine now what are some of the metrics, I guess, out there? Or is it just on, we've always did good in that city. What's that look like?
It really starts with how long they're going to be out touring to begin with. If they say they're going to be out for a month, then they're going to go back and probably, if they haven't been out for a while, they'll go back and repeat the cities historically that have been, you know, strong for them all along. you know, with a lot of these groups, especially the ones that I book that have been around for a while, we have the luxury of some data and research and knowledge of what groups do in various markets. And if not exactly that group, groups like them that, you know, you can figure out the audience, like a John Lodge and an Alan Parsons and a John Anderson, for instance. You know, if one of them did good in the market, chances are the others are going to do good. So you have to be really quick about it, too, because when the word goes out that somebody's going to tour that's desirable to put on in concert, you're going to have people from all over the place, not necessarily competing for your market, but for other markets. And back to the beginning, they're only going to be out for so long. So they're going to pick either the best offers that go in the right geographical routing, you know, and that's basically, it's not a real secret of how they're doing it. They're trying to play all the right places where there's the most people that want to see them. And then, you know, along the way, they pick up other markets where they've never been before. Maybe it's a little bit more of a crapshoot, but again, you can draw from what other similar type of acts have done in the past to kind of understand, you know, whether or not you got a good enough audience there.
Almost like an Apple playlist.
Well, yeah, but put a map on the wall you know, and look at the state. And, you know, a lot of these groups keep very good track of what their business is. They know what their business is. A lot of these groups work with the same people over the years. So there's no secrets. Everybody knows how the last one did and the one before that. And it's fun to do, you know, a life like that with people. There's so many acts that I've done for decades, and we wouldn't think about not working with each other, and it remains fun. Like with John Lodge, for example.
Yeah. Any chance of John coming back to the West Coast here this year, or?
Maybe in November. We were talking about it the other night, and he'd like to come out for a while. He lives in Florida now, so it's not about the weather, but he just loves to play. He doesn't need to do it. He just wants to. And he's such a good guy, you know. What a talent.
So Dave and I, of course, were Yes Heads, so we're very excited about John Anderson coming. We're going to try to get him to do an interview with us. We've interviewed him twice before, believe it or not, and we love John.
Oh, great.
How's the ticket sales for John Anderson, and then how does that compare to Steve Howe running around with Yes? How do those two play against each other?
You know, it's interesting. In some markets, Yes does really well, and in others not as well. John, on the other hand, as well known as he is, you know, he's not known as John Anderson the hit maker. He's known as John Anderson the singer from Yes. So, you know, these days what's going on, you know, as life goes on and time moves by, you have so many of these great artists from the 60s, 70s, 80s that still perform, want to keep the music alive, but for whatever reason, people from their bands either don't want to, or they're incapacitated, or they died.
Sure.
And the bottom line turns into, are there enough fans out there to come and see that music performed live with different people at the helm? Some people are real purists about it. I get it, but it's kind of silly. You know, I mean, how many original vintage cars with no new parts do you see out there?
Sure.
That's life, baby.
Oh, I'm with you. My thing with Yes is the new singer sounds like he's singing through his nose, so he just doesn't do it for me. Sorry.
I have to add an aside to that. His name's John Davison.
He seems like a nice guy.
I don't completely agree with you, but he's married to John Lodge's daughter, and he's out on tour with John as well.
Well,
so I was just with them in those shows we just did, and
he seems like a pleasant, beautiful man. I'm just saying I don't dig his singing. That's it. That's all.
Yeah, he comes out and does Tuesday afternoon and Nights in White Satin and kills it.
Well, good.
Anyway,
I think he should tour with John Lodge more. Hold on for a sec.
The thing is with these bands, they're never going to be, the exact same as the way that you hear it in your head.
Correct.
And you know, they give it their best shot. And you see, this is kind of why they don't do the exact same business they would do if all the originals were there, for that very reason.
All right, hold that thought. We got to go to a hard news break. We'll come back with Danny Zalisco. Wake up, Tucson. All right, 8:34 in the morning. We're back with David Slavin and Danny Zalisco, concert promoter extraordinaire. I got one quick other question I want to get out of my skull, and I know Dave's got one for you. I always wonder, Danny, how does the, when they are doing their set list and choosing songs, but they're songs written by other people, either from their band that's no longer in the band or even a cover. How does that work in relation to paying off the person to use their song? Is there a standardized thing to that? Or I assume that's pre-negotiated before they hit the road. How does that work?
Anybody can go on stage and sing anything anywhere. But if you're going to sell it, like a live record, or sell it to a streaming company or anything like that, when you bring the money into it, what happens is you got to share it. But in the simple case where people are just coming on stage and singing somebody's song, nothing happens.
Okay.
You don't have to pay to use it.
Okay. I wasn't sure about that.
It's more of a copyright thing. They collect performance fees for every show, and somehow that money dribbles down to whoever the writer was or whatever, you know, and that's how they make their money as writers. I don't know how they keep track of it. I mean, think about it. There's a million shows going on every night all over the world, yep. and people are singing and playing those songs. It's a very long and complicated process, but bottom line, you can sing anything you want.
So do you, as a concert promoter, have to pay ASCAP and BMI rights fees
yes.
before every show?
Not before. You do it based on how many people show up, which is really weird.
Is there a standard fee for every act, or is it different for different acts?
It's a standard fee for everybody, but it varies based on your ticket price and how many people you do. So it turns into all that.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
We're asking Danny Zalisco all those things you wanted to ask, but we're afraid to.
Yeah. How do you pick between when an act is going on tour? This is Dave Slavin again, by the way. How do you pick between when you're bringing them to Tucson between the different venues? You've got the Linda Ronstadt Music Hall, the arena down here at TCC, and the Rialto and the Fox Theater. Is there a metric that you use that one time, it seems like one time there an act will be at the Fox and a year later or 2 years later they're at the Rialto? Is that by design or just happenstance?
Sometimes it's just as simple as when somebody says, hey, get us the availabilities in your town for February. And we go and we check those dates. We supply them to them. Then they've got to put it into the process and route the tour out. Then it comes down to which place is open that night. If both of them are open, then, you know, a lot of times the hall will have, the group will have history with playing at either or both of those halls. And oftentimes they're the ones that are going to pick, you know, where they're going to play. I might remind them, hey, you played here last time, or you did better at this one over that one last time, or you're just not big enough to be, say, in the Music Hall, which is double the size of the Fox or the Rialto. You know, it comes down to where are we going to do the best? And where, you know, I mean, if you're in a bigger place, theoretically, you can think, well, maybe we can drop the ticket prices to attract more people. But when you go into a bigger hall, the expenses go up. So it's kind of one of those things where they offset each other.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
All right, so let's go. So, again, we're hitting Danny with all these different questions about the nuts and bolts of this. How does a ticket price break down? Act, Danny, anything else out there? What's the basic breakdown of a ticket price on where the money goes to?
Overall, you know, that with most groups, we know approximately what the audience is used to paying from before. We try not to raise them, but as you know, with costs being the way they are these days, not to mention for the local stuff, the stagehands, the catering, those are two of the area, advertising, those are all things that we have to pay for to continue to rise. Also, the artist costs continue to rise. Hotels are more expensive, gasoline, renting vehicles, renting equipment, whatever. So you have to come up with a price that you're going to pay the band. You got to plug it in with how much is it going to cost you to produce the show. And then you look at the capacity of the building. And we've been in most of these buildings that we're working in many times before. So we already have an idea of how the prices for the tickets should break down in terms of how many seats at this price, that price, the other. And then you just do some simple math. It's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. I mean, you're kind of just moving around the numbers to make them fit and work, and you end up with this final picture that says this makes sense, or that's really too high. We can't charge that much, you know. And sometimes we'll pass on doing a show because they simply want too much, and I'm guessing or using whatever data I've got to try to, you know, say you guys are asking the fair price, the right price. Or you're asking too much, and they'll go out shopping for another buyer, and oftentimes they'll get it. But it always boils down to, and from the very beginning, what does the artist need? Where do they need to play? And how do those costs come into play? And you add them up, and you come up with a number saying, if I did this show right now, this is what would happen. And you know, you go from there and decide, does this make sense or am I nuts?
Yeah. Is there a price point you won't go over right now?
You can't use that as a general rule because every show, every audience, every group, every hall is different. So you've got to look at everything on a one-off basis to make sure that, you know, you're just not assuming, oh, that'll never work. I've had many, many times where when I've really, you know, sharpened the pencil and looked at it, you go based on your past results and your gut, and you go, is this going to work or not? And most of the times, I happen to guess right because I'm still here.
So tell me about right now, what show of the last, you know, last 6 months, upcoming 6 months, is your highest price point for a ticket right now?
You know, a lot of the tickets that were the top price tickets, I would say they level off at about 125, and there's generally about 100 or 200 of those. And I think that's a lot of money for tickets, even though they're down in front. But let's face it, this is the time that we're living in right now. One of the, you know, competitors with us are third-party ticket sellers who buy tickets as soon as they go on sale, and they try to hoard all the good seats so that people have to go to them for a good seat, which I resent. I think it should be illegal. You shouldn't be able to sell tickets for anything you want, because this is different. This is just not a regular product. It's an experience. It's a memory. It's your favorite group and all that stuff. And if I don't have them competing with me for tickets, I can afford to price tickets at a far better ticket price for the audience. What happens is these people go and buy the first 5 rows or 10 rows or whatever, and they're charging $200-$300, and the band goes, why aren't we making that? The fact of the matter is people will only pay those ridiculous prices when they can't have them. And they're incited, I have to get my girlfriend that front row ticket, and they'll pay anything for it. But none of us see that money. So it's like they're buying it and reselling it. And from our standpoint, you know, we're trying to get back to break even and make some money as fast as possible too, but we don't want to gouge people. I mean, if I come out with a ticket price that says $200 for somebody at the Fox or the Rialto, people are going, what are you, high?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
But then you go online, and half the time people don't even know what website they're looking at. They don't know if they're looking at the real one or a scalper one, and then they start going, oh, tickets are too expensive, they're $300. No, they're not.
Right.
When you see that, go back and make sure you're looking at my website or the promoter's website or the hall's website.
Or the artist's website.
Well, the artist too, because all of our internet stuff is connected to go to the same place to try to avoid that fraud, you know. And that's what it is. I mean, it's we just kind of go over this and over this, trying to make deals the best we can, and also to benefit the audience by trying to be cool with the ticket prices. And then these other people come in who have no stake in the game. They don't do this for a living. They're just there to make money, and they don't care. It's just another piece of paper.
So, Danny, I assume the resellers are selling most of those tickets. Are there instances where they bought those first 3 rows, the act shows up, and most of the first 3 rows are empty? What's going on there?
Well, sometimes that'll happen, and you'll see those guys out in front trying to sell, get $5, get anything. Doesn't help me out when I've got normally priced tickets and I'm hoping people will walk up and buy tickets. Then you're on your way to the box office and some clown's got a $50 ticket for $10, I'm screwed then.
Right.
It's like they get me twice. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. Nice to hear you say that, though, about the third-party ticket sellers. It has unnerved me many times, and I've learned myself to go to the artist website or your website, for instance, as we talked.
It's definitely the way to go because these guys use, the scalpers use vernacular very close to what we use. You know, it'll say Rialto Theater Tucson instead of Rialto.com, and people think they're on the venue website. You got to make sure you're on the right one. And a sure tip-off is if you see tickets at like $200, $300, you're at the wrong place.
Yeah.
Tell me about the, I'm going to use the T word in front of you, Ticketmaster. Tell me about that mess. Is that how they've changed? Have they changed at all? Are they worse? Are they better? Give me the state of Ticketmaster in relation to you as a promoter and then the actual concert goer.
Well, you know, this is going back and forth and going on for a long time. It's very difficult as an independent promoter to know that every time you go into a building that uses Ticketmaster, they're going to have all of your information. They have the people that bought the tickets. They know how many were bought. They know when they were bought. They know everything about your business. To me, that's a little bit unsettling. I don't really like that. However, I will also say at this time in my life that it's not like I'm not competing over arena acts the way that I used to. I've pretty much been pushed out of there by the fact that there are promoters, not just one, but there's a couple who can buy 30, 40, 50 show tours at, you know, one at a time. And they don't want partners. They don't want people like me around, so they control everything. It gives people too much control over what's going to end up happening with any given tour, in my book. In their book, they don't think they're doing anything wrong, and technically they're not. But it is a weird thing when one promoter owns the largest ticketing company in the world.
Right.
It just gives them an advantage and power that takes it away from everybody else. You know, so if you're a big band, you're doing right by doing business with them. They have, you know, they have more money to deal with than they do by dealing with the likes of me or other people who aren't as big as them. So I don't know what's going to happen with that. I mean, I guess it's being looked at. It's in court. You know, it's not all as wicked as they would make you think, but they are. It's a very expensive system to operate, and it's also a very expensive system to be working with as a customer, because on any given ticket, you're looking at paying charges of $10, $15, $20, depending on the ticket price, and basically, in your mind, when you're buying a ticket, you've got to cook that number into your final purchase price and say, I got to go to this show. I'm doing it. A lot of people complain, well, there's these extra charges. Well, there's extra charges everywhere you go in life. It doesn't make it okay. I'm just saying that's the way it is. And it's easier to understand that and try to work with that in your head than fight it every time you buy a ticket. It's $100 for two tickets. I'm paying $130. Well, that's what you're paying. It's 65 apiece instead of 50. Is that going to make you stop from going? I hope not.
Well, again, we appreciate that. This is just good hard info that I love. So we got to go one more break, Danny. Just hold on, and we'll be back. And we'll. I know Dave's got a question for you, and if we have time, I got one more for you. So
you got it.
Thanks, Danny. We're talking to Danny Zalisco, and. We're having a good time talking about one of our favorite things, which is live music. So you're on Wake Up Tucson, 10:30 The Voice. Josh and Grant are coming up next on Jump in Tucson. All right. Yes, doing a little different version of Roundabout, little Chicago shuffle there. We're hanging out with Danny Zlisko and our good friend David Slavin's here. Welcome back, David.
Hey, thank you very much, Chris.
Hop into your question before we run out of time.
And thank you, Danny. Hey, Danny, question. Yeah. I remember reading in, first off, you're celebrating 50 years of promoting concerts. Congratulations to you. And we've all been the beneficiaries of your work. Second thing, I remember reading a chapter in a book by Jonathan Cain of Journey, where he credited you with helping put Journey back together again in the late 90s.
This is true.
Look at that. Tell us
nobody,
more.
Well, it was the late 90s. Perry wasn't coming back. They wanted to go out and play again. But remember, this is over 25 years ago, and there weren't that many groups thinking it was possible to replace the main singer, the front man in their group, and get away with it and carry on. I know it happened a few times before that. But this was, hell, I don't remember when Brian Johnson replaced Bon Scott, but I mean, there was another similar one. And they had this guy called Steve Aggeri, who was very good. And they wanted to go out as Journey and perform with this new singer. And none of the promoters were having it. They said, oh, no, you can't replace Steve Perry. Well, we decided to go give it a try. And I had 40 shows all around the country. I was doing it with a guy out of Florida. And it wasn't as expensive as you might think, because as far as they were concerned, they were looking at it the right way, which is like starting over. You already have this great, you know, catalog of hits and songs that you can play, and it's the same band except for a new singer, so let's go out and play in auditoriums, like 2,000 seats. I had 40 shows, and at the very end, I'm like sweating it going, I have to drop everything I'm doing and go out and do this. So I said to the agent, call up all the usual promoters that have done Journey forever and say to them, do you really want to see an ad in the paper or hear it on the radio where it says Evening Star or Danny Zlisko presents Journey? And at the end of the day, I had 8 shows. 32 came up, you know, that people that played before. And I mean, the sound advice was, take this show. People are going to come and see Journey live, you know, and it's going to be a different singer. That's all. So there was a lot, you know, there was some pushback, but for the most part, all the shows did great. The only one I didn't succeed with was Vancouver, but everywhere else we did either sold out or came really close, and Journey was back.
Wow. Great story.
And again, right, that's a Neil Schoen. That's pretty much 100% Neil right now, Journey.
Well, it's Neil and John.
I mean business wise.
Well, I since then we've had these dances where we were going to work together more and didn't, and again, I wish them luck. I have no idea what's going on out there, but they're playing a big stadium tour at Def Leppard. It's a big deal.
Yep, they're coming to Phoenix, I think, later in August with that show.
That's what I've heard.
So real quick, so we're excited for John Anderson and the Band Geeks coming up on the 14th, and then Beat in September, which it sounds like Beat is booked so many tickets. They're coming to do the Rialto in December, so that's good to hear.
I haven't heard about that yet.
Well, okay. Ticket sales for Beat have been so good that supposedly, hopefully I didn't do anything behind your back.
Well, we're going to find out when I hang up.
Because, you know, I was all planning to go. I'm still going to go see him at Celebrity in September. And then all of a sudden I saw that they were playing Tucson in
December.
So,
I don't know a thing about it.
Danny's going to have to go kick somebody's ass after this. So that's beautiful. They're playing December 17th at the Fox. So,
well, good for them.
Danny, love talking to you about this stuff. We could talk to you all day. So
thank you, Danny.
Congratulations on 50 years, man. It's been really fun, and hopefully we can do it again one day.
All right, you guys, anytime you want, I'm happy to do it.
Thanks, amigo. Have a good day.
Thank you, Danny.
All right. You have a great day.
All right. The great Danny Zalisco. David, thanks for a good interview. Thanks for setting that up, too. Appreciate it.
Always fun.
And well, we got more coming up in the future. So Grant and Josh are coming up. They're going to do primary breakdown and get call-ins from Juan Siskamani and Heather Lappin. And tomorrow we have Schweikert and our second in America's best Mexican food interviews. Wake up.